Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We'll begin with oral argument in the case of United States against Durham and others. Mr. Rodriguez.
May it please the Court. My name is Ruben Rodriguez, appointed to represent appellant Tony Kallion. There are three issues I'd like to touch upon today. The first, the lower court's abuse of discretion in refusing to clarify jury confusion. The second, the insufficiency of the evidence with which to uphold a conviction for attempted bank extortion. And third, the sentencing issue, that Charles Zachary is not a victim under the sentencing guidelines. It is well established that a court has an obligation to dispel any confusion quickly and with concrete accuracy. The question from the jury here showed confusion on a matter of law, specifically whether the jury had to find more than just presence or knowledge of a crime to convict Kallion of attempted bank extortion after convicting him of conspiracy. The court, over the defendant's objection, told the jury to reread the instructions. The government relies on United States v. Spann for the position that telling a jury to reread instructions is enough to clarify confusion. But the situation in Spann differs significantly from the case here. The trial court in Spann's practice was to not give copies of the instruction to the jury, and in response to a question directly answered by the instructions, provided copies to the jury and told them to reread the instructions. Here, the jury had copies, in fact, quoted from the instructions themselves in asking their question, and was still confused. By telling the jury to merely reread the instructions, the court relegated a conclusion of law to the jury, namely whether Kallion could be convicted of attempted extortion by presence alone. And in this case, the failure to clarify the jury confusion was prejudicial. At worst, the court could have interpreted the silence as no, leading the jury to the erroneous conclusion of law that presence alone was enough to convict Kallion of attempted extortion. And presence is particularly important in this case, since there's a lot of testimony that Kallion wasn't present during the morning while demands were being made by Zachary. The second issue I'd like to discuss is the insufficiency of the evidence with which to uphold a conviction for attempted extortion. At trial, the government failed to prove that Kallion had the requisite specific intent to commit bank extortion. At most, the evidence supported a finding that Kallion intended to extort Zachary and that Zachary's funds were possibly at TCF Bank. And I would specifically refer the court to the testimony of Gibbs and Hoisington, and in particular, Hoisington's testimony that Zachary said his money was in the bank and that his girlfriend would get it. And that testimony is specifically at pages 262 and pages 329 of the appendix.
Is it clear that this is a specific intent to crime?
I believe so, Your Honor. As such, we request that this court acknowledge...
You want to back that up?
I believe we're dealing with an attempt crime. It's attempted bank extortion, and in order to fulfill the intent requirement, the defendant must have the specific intent to extort a bank. We request that this court acknowledge a circuit split between this circuit and the Fifth Circuit. And I'd like to point out an error in the briefing, in our briefing and the government's briefing. We referred to Vann as a Ninth Circuit case. That's actually a Fifth Circuit case. So it's a split between this circuit and the Fifth Circuit. And we ask this court to reconsider its decision in United States v. McCarter and hold that a defendant who sets out to rob an individual does not commit federal bank extortion simply because the funds extorted might come from an individual's bank account.
Well, didn't he approve the plan, according to Gibbs?
He approved the plan to extort Zachary, which, I mean, was the scope to extort money from Nellie, from Bob, trying to get at sources of Zachary's money. And at some point, Zachary suggested his money was in the bank, according to Hoisington's testimony, and that they were going to get the money from the bank.
But Lorenzo was going to get the money, right?
Lorenzo was going to get his money, Zachary's money, from the bank.
Right, and Kallion knew of that, according to Gibbs.
According to Gibbs, Kallion did know of that money.
Isn't that the end of things? Under the Pinkerton Doctrine, every member of a joint criminal venture is equally responsible for all crimes committed in the course of that venture. So if he agreed to help kidnap Zachary and other members of this venture extorted money from the bank, one would think that's QED.
That might be enough for the conspiracy charge, Your Honor, but for the attempt charge?
No, this is actually, Pinkerton doesn't depend on conspiracy charges. It is a substantive theory of criminal liability.
Well, Your Honor, I would submit that the defendant would still require to have the specific intent with which to commit bank extortion.
No, actually, that just disagrees with Pinkerton. Pinkerton says that your that person A is substantively responsible for all crimes committed by B and C, even if he didn't know that B and C committed crimes as part of the same joint venture.
Your Honor, does that not require that the crimes are reasonably related to the object of the conspiracy?
Be part of the joint venture.
Well, we also submit that this was not reasonably related to the object of the conspiracy, which was to extort Zachary personally rather than the bank and the bank's funds. And I would specifically point the court to the Fifth Circuit's decision in Burton, which was unpersuaded by McCarter and declined to follow it. The third issue I'd like to discuss is the sentencing issue, and that Charles Zachary is not a victim of attempted extortion. The government can't have it both ways. Either Zachary was the target of the extortion or the bank was the target of the extortion, as the government has argued consistently throughout this case. The sentencing enhancement at issue here, 2B32B4A, plainly requires bodily injury to the victims of the extortion demand. Other areas of the enhancement guidelines provide enhancements if any person is abducted. Other enhancements don't refer to any particular victim at all, specifically the ones referring to firearms and the threat of death. And specifically, all cases cited in the briefing apply this enhancement to situations where employees or agents of the target of the extortion were injured. The First Circuit's decision in Hughes is descriptive of this fact. The target of the extortion was a corporation, and the victim was the corporation's president. And I have reached my rebuttal time if there are no other questions. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Rodriguez. Mr. Clavelli.
May it please this honorable court and counsel for the government. Your Honor, I represent today Mr. Israel Collins, who entered a plea of guilty primarily on the basis of Section 2, admitting that he was responsible for the conduct of his co-defendants, and he pled guilty to counts 2 and 3, 3 being the 924C gun, consecutive sentence required, and two being the extortion of Mr. Zachary and the involvement of the bank. And that was done through a plea declaration. Your Honor, we feel that each of the items that are required for a procedural and substantive reasonable sentence were violated in this case. We feel the judge treated the guidelines as mandatory, particularly the career criminal aspect, because he was required to follow Welton. He failed to consider the 3553A factors, particularly the rehabilitative potential of a person who entered a plea of guilty, and the necessity of a sentence of 271 months. Under A2, he did not consider the disparate impact when somebody like Mr. Callion, who had and Mr. Durham, Mr. Callion got the maximum sentence on count two, 240 months, but his guidelines were 262 months. And he could have entered a total sentence if he had thought it was reasonable to do so by taking some of the time from count one, the conspiracy, and adding it to the 240 months. So apparently Judge Kaur believed that 240 months was reasonable. That leads us to the inescapable conclusion that he felt himself bound by the career criminal guidelines. He also relied on some facts which he was wrong to do by looking at the arrest report in a weapons possession case and telling me that he could not ignore the fact that the arrest report said that a woman was struck with a gun when there was no violent aspect of that information even brought. And of course, the conviction was for simple possession. So that was yet another error by following information that was not reliable.
I thought Judge Kaur agreed during the colloquy about that, that he couldn't.
He disagreed with me. He actually said, I cannot ignore that information. And I'm saying, but Shepard says you must. It's just in the arrest report. It wasn't part of the conviction. It wasn't even part of the charge.
What does Shepard have to do with this?
Because
Shepard doesn't have anything to do with sentencing. It only has to do with recidivist liability.
Well, I do cite some cases, including a Seventh Circuit case, where I believed Shepard did come into play because...
You have to overrule a whole bunch of cases to hold that Shepard is applicable to sentencing.
All right. Well, I do believe that a recent case of this court came out where they do talk about that. Came out, I think, April 4th. And it is true, there are some uses that can be made, but I believe in this case, he accepted as accurate something that was in the arrest report, and my client denied it. He actually denied it.
I understood that the context of this conversation was not about whether to count this conviction and look behind it to the facts of the underlying crime, but just to take into account the argument that you were making, and I can't remember if it was you or another counsel, but that Mr. Collins' counsel was making about whether this was Mr. Collins' first involvement in a crime with a gun.
Violent crime.
Violent crime with a gun.
I said it's his first involvement in a violent crime involving a gun. That was when he brought up the unlawful use of weapons. And I also told him that the Hunter case said that possession of a gun is not a violent crime.
Well, right. I'm not talking about for counting purposes. I'm talking about just for the holistic approach to sentencing and to respond to the argument that you were making.
The argument was the judge says some things that were not clear, in my opinion, regarding the career criminal statute. He said that he agreed with the policy. Well, everybody agrees with the policy. A person who continues to commit crimes, particularly when they're more serious and more serious, is always going to get a higher sentence. That is what a career criminal is. It is the application of the policy, which he admitted he sometimes disagrees with. And he should have disagreed with it here because one of the two predicate offenses is a single gram. And he said, I don't like applying career criminal when we have a small drug offense. And you have the small drug offense here. And I pointed it out to him. And once again, he goes to the violence.
Well, it sounds like the judge then did understand his discretion, notwithstanding that this occurred between Corner and Welton, and it was specifically acknowledged by the prosecutor, as I understand it, there was discretion.
Page 10 of their submission, they say that the court is bound by Welton. We don't think Welton was properly decided. Crookie decided. They cite a First Circuit case. He could not do anything but follow Welton. When you look at Callion's 240-month sentence, when you look at the fact that Callion's guidelines were 262, he went below Callion's guidelines. Obviously, he thought 240 was reasonable. Why would you give a guy that was less involved, pled guilty, and who doesn't have a murder conviction like Callion does, his criminal history is not as severe, why would you give him more time unless you had to? So to me, the proof is there. All you have to do is kind of look back and forth between the procedural and the substantive, and it's rather obvious. He didn't come right out and say it, but he had to follow Welton. And then when we get to the 924C, Your Honors, I just feel his statement that Welton has nothing to do with the increase in harm. I'm sorry, Dean and the Smith case, that he was just wrong. In this case, the discharge of the firearm did not involve any harm or increase in harm or violence in the offense. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Mr. McGowan.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. Andrew McGowan with the Federal Defender's Office for the Central District of Illinois. I represent Sherman Swopes. Mr. Swopes appeals his sentence. I intend to address the mention of guns while summarizing Mr. Swope's criminal history, as well as the related question of the standard of review. unless this court has any questions about any of the other issues. The government has argued that the court should review this for plain error because defense counsel did not object to the district court's mention of guns when summarizing the basis for the sentence. However, the rules do not require a litigant to complain about a judicial choice after it has been made. In this case, Mr. Swopes argued for a lower sentence, gave a basis for that argument, and the district court rejected that and gave his explanation for the sentence that the court imposed. Under those circumstances, this is sufficiently preserved for review. The government also argues that the district court was referring to the guns in this case, not any guns in Mr. Swope's past. However, considering what the district court said, the government's argument is not well supported by the record. What the district court said was, and his prior involvement with violent offenses, drugs, and guns means he does represent a risk to the community. Now, the problem with the district court's apparent belief that there were guns in Mr. Swope's past is that when you combine it with the guns in this present offense, it looks as though there's a pattern that Mr. Swopes may or may not be able to break. The district court was certainly not convinced that education or treatment would actually change things, although he was willing to accept it, that it could happen. And so this particular error, even though it's a small statement in the statement of facts or statement of basis for the sentence, could have made a big difference in the sentence, especially given that the judge didn't really give a broad statement. It was about a page and a half, I believe. Anyway, unless there are any questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Berner.
May it please the court, counsels. The government would ask that this court affirm the convictions of Callion and of defendants Callion and Durham and affirm the sentences of Collins and Swopes. I would just like to touch on what some of the issues that were raised by defense counsel. First of all, the issue of the jury question. The court has broad discretion to respond to jury questions, and there is no doubt that a court has a duty to clear up confusion. But the assumption here is that the jury was confused. There is no evidence in this case that the jury was confused. They put out a question. The court read the question to both counsels. There was a disagreement on how the question should be answered. And so the court took the least intrusive action and asked the jury to reread the instructions. The jury reread the instructions, and a little over an hour later, they reached a verdict. This is not a situation like in Duran, where the jury sent out multiple questions asking for clarification. This is one question. The judge took the least intrusive action. And if the judge had answered the question, he may have answered the question in a way that may have been unfavorable to Mr. Callion, in that whether or not the mere presence in instruction applies to count two after the defendant has been already convicted of conspiracy. So the government would argue that there was no confusion here, and that the district court did the correct and proper thing. As far as the sufficiency of evidence arguments are concerned, the government believes that not only was there sufficient evidence to convict these defendants of the specific intent of attempt bank extortion, but there also was sufficient evidence to show that these defendants were in a conspiracy to commit attempt bank extortion. And this, when you read the record, you see that Tony Callion, as early as May of 2008, knew that Luella Dorenzo, the girlfriend of Charles Zachary, worked at a TCF bank. He told the agents that he believed she had a key to the vault. And he was the person that set this whole situation in motion. So when he kidnapped, when he and the others kidnapped Charles Zachary, it is reasonable to assume that they were not only looking to get money from other sources, but by having him contact Dorenzo, she was in play from the very beginning because of her relationship with TCF Bank. And when the other individuals joined that conspiracy and took the steps that they took in kidnapping Charles Zachary, holding him against his will, beating him with a gun, intimidating him with pit bull dogs, torturing him with pliers to get him to give up sources of money, to the point where he says, "I will call my girlfriend and we will get and she'll get the money from the bank." If there's any doubt prior to those, prior to the 5 o'clock conversation, the 5 a.m. conversation, there is no doubt after the 5 a.m. conversation. Because at that time, all the defendants were present in the kitchen when Daniel Gibbs told them that he had had a conversation with Zachary, and Zachary said that he was going to get the money from the bank. And how do we know it didn't come from a bank account? Because Callahan told him to get it from a safe deposit box. And what was Zachary's response? "It's not coming from a safe deposit box." That's when he could have said, "It's coming from my checking account. It's coming from my savings account." He didn't say that. He's saying it's coming from the bank. And then all the activity afterwards, the going to find the drop-off point, the continuous calls to Dorenzo, Dorenzo saying on the recordings, I can't just walk out with all this money. If she was just going to her ATM machine and withdrawing money, she would not have made those comments. The fact of the matter is that those defendants overheard those conversations through the chirp phones, and they then went and tried to find the money. And when they found the money, it was in a TCF bag. Durham recovers the money. He throws the bag out of his window on the way back to the house on the instructions of Callahan so that they could distance themselves from the bank. And when they get back to the bank, they find the money wrapped in bank bands, and they start separating the money. This was clearly an attempt to extort money from TCF Bank. Yes, there were other opportunities that were sought to try and get money from other sources, but that doesn't mean that a jury could not reasonably find from the facts presented in this case that the attempted bank extortion was a major part of this crime. I would say that when it comes to whether Charles Zachary is a victim, there are many victims in this case, certainly. TCF Bank is a victim. But when you look at the enhancement guideline, the enhancement guideline assumes a broader category of victim than just the bank. And in Hughes, the First Circuit held that there may be victims of an extortionate demand other than the target of the extortionate demand. It strains credulity to say that Charles Zachary, after all that he went through, was not a victim in this crime. And when you look at the indefinite article, any victim in the enhancement, it suggests that there are victims that could be part of a broader category of victim than that was just enumerated for the purposes of loss to the victim, which would be the bank. Zachary was kidnapped, he was beaten, he was tortured, he was held against his will, a gun was fired towards his leg. There is no question that he was a victim within the meaning of Guideline Section 2B3.2. Getting to Defendant Collins' sentence, the arrest report issue, I believe the judge is correct when she observes that when it came to the arrest report issue, Judge Kaur did not base his calculation on the UUW matter. He was simply clarifying what the defendant's counsel had said about the prior history of Israel Collins. the defense counsel was trying to say that this particular case was the only case where he was involved in using a gun. But there was this incident. There was this unlawful use of weapons incident where there was violence. For purposes of Section 3553A, the court couldn't ignore that, and he had to clarify the record that the fact that there was evidence in the PSR that this particular defendant had acted violently in the past. But when you look at Judge Court's comments, you see clearly that he based his decision on properly calculating the guideline sentence. This defendant was an armed career criminal because of his prior record, and in addition to the fact he was convicted of a charge which Collins and Durham were acquitted of, and that is the gun charge. So, of course, his sentence was going to be higher because of the 120 months additional to the sentence for count one and count two.
Yeah, a more difficult question is the Welton question.
Yes.
Would you clarify the position that the government took on that issue?
Sure.
In the district court?
Yes.
I'm not entirely clear on whether you told the judge he was bound by Welton or that he had discretion to consider this issue.
Yes, Your Honor. In Welton, in the government's sentencing memorandum, the government specifically said that even though Welton is law, that the government believed that the court had discretion in this matter. There is no evidence in the record in Judge Court's comments that he felt constrained by Welton. And some of the cases that defense counsel cites, there was a case where a judge was saying, well, Welton is controlling. Judge Court makes no reference to Welton really at all. What strikes Judge Court in this case is the brazenness of this particular crime coupled with the defendant's criminal history. That the fact that a person just riding his bike down the street who would be approached and asked to engage in an armed kidnapping would all of a sudden just say, okay. That was what Judge Kaur was concerned about when he imposed sentence. He did say that at times he disagrees with the armed career criminal policy, but he was clear in his comments because when he said that in this case I have no disagreement with the policy here because we have a dangerous person and this person needs to have a sentence that is appropriate to the crime and to his criminal history. There is no evidence from the record that Judge Kaur felt that Welton was somehow controlling or that he had no discretion to sentence the court or sentence the defendant outside of the guidelines range. He felt that a guideline sentence in this case, because of these facts and this defendant's criminal history, was necessary. I would, as far as the gun discharge is concerned, defendants try to bootstrap a substantive fear of fear of risk or harm is in order to say that Dean should apply. Dean does not require a subjective fear of harm in order for the gun enhancement to apply. The court in Dean was explaining why Congress enacted the enhancement, but Congress said never. The court said that Congress never intended that a fear or risk of harm be a predicate for the enhancement. And so, when it comes to the argument that the enhancement doesn't apply because there was no fear or risk of harm, a reading of Dean doesn't suggest that. And so we would argue that the court properly found that Dean applies in this case and that the gun discharge was applicable. And finally, as far as the defendant Swopes is concerned, I would just touch on the fact that no evidence of diminished capacity was introduced at sentencing, and to argue the defendant's position that the court's reference of defendant's prior use of guns We don't believe that is sufficient grounds for a reversal of his entire sentence. It is reasonable to conclude that Judge Kaur was referring to the defendant's use of guns in the present case. And at worst, the judge made a minor misstatement of facts. But the court gave ample reasons, again, as to why it found Sherman Swopes eligible for his particular sentence. And the court enumerated what he felt, again, were the circumstances where a person who just had no connection to these people were just willing to go and commit an armed abduction at the spur of the moment. For those reasons, Your Honor, we believe that Sherman Swopes' sentence should be affirmed, and we believe that the convictions of Tony Callion and Hal Durham should be affirmed as well. Thank you very much.
Counsel, yeah. I want to talk to you for just a second about Swopes.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate that you're not the author of the brief, but you represent the government, and obviously you're representing the brief, and I don't want to speak in derogation of your able presentation this morning. But the brief on page 57 says, regarding the gun issue, that is the statement by Judge Kaur about prior use of guns, no mistake was made because the court, and then, quote, and not quote, in context is the text, was referring to the defendant's use of guns during the particular offense. Government's a major litigator before this court. All counsel need to rely on the credibility of their representations. I appreciate the argument that he may well have been using in referencing to what went on before. But the statement does say prior use of guns. It would be much more helpful and add to the credibility of the government's brief if the recognition was made that there was no prior use, in the sense that you might argue he likely was referring to the context of the gun use. But to not acknowledge the direct statement made by the district judge, which was clearly an error. And I don't want to speak to plain error. I'm speaking to government's presentation in this written work before us and of course, your oral presentation. That it's distressing to me that isn't confronted in a little different manner. The one count brings almost 15 years. The one that's so clearly count two.
Yes.
And we're talking about a sentence here that's 23 years or so. It seems to me that whatever the sentence would be, it would help from my perspective, if the government would reflect on the way it drafted the brief in this regard.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Bruner. Anything further, Mr. Rodriguez?
With regards to the jury instruction, the judge actually suggested how he might answer it. If you look at page 387 of the appendix of the trial transcript, the judge said that the first sentence that the jury had a question on had nothing to do with conspiracy and that the second sentence does. So that suggests the way the judge would have answered the question. As to the sentencing issue, the government again relies on Hughes, but the issue in Hughes that the court was dealing with was whether the president of the corporation was properly the victim under the sentencing enhancement. And that comports with with what we've been saying in this case, in that the target of the extortion and its employees, its agents, someone with a nexus to the target of the extortion is the appropriate victim under the sentencing enhancement.
But the guideline does refer to any victim.
It does refer to any victim, but it also refers to any person and has other elements that have no particular victim. So that would lead to that would suggest that any person would probably be broader than the any victim situation. If there are no other questions.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Clavelli.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, it is only unwarranted disparities which are permitted
because of 3553A6. Now, we would be in better shape to talk about it had the judge actually addressed the 3553A6 factors, which I believe he did not, particularly why he felt 271 months was necessary. But to respond to the court's question about the gun being another instance of violence, which counsel also mentioned, it was in a case which came down on April 4th, which I just saw over the weekend, Guajardo Martinez, where it talks about the accuracy of information in arrest reports, and particularly the court can rely on it unless it's denied, and my client specifically denied any violence, and the actual information that was brought had no violence in it. So I feel I'm on good grounds that information is not accurate.
Thank you, Mr. Covelli.
Am I done, or may I have another moment?
Time has expired.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Mr.
Brigalow.
Not unless the court has any questions.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Rodriguez, Mr. Clavelli, we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment in this case and your assistance to the court as well as your clients. The case is taken under advisement.